I'm W.S. Thackeray. I'm interviewing again Commodore A. Graham Bridgman. It's the 27th of June, 1980.
There, wait, off we go.
Well, as I said earlier, in August, I guess it was, 1952, I arrived with my wife and two children in Ottawa, having driven across the country by car. Really hot summer. Motels weren't very prevalent in those days, and we stayed in some pretty shabby places. And we arrived in Ottawa in an extremely hot summer. I found that my job was to be assistant engineer in chief for machinery design, and our office was in A building of the three temporary buildings that were in Ottawa. I'd served briefly in one of those before, so I was familiar with them. The air conditioning was, as before, non-existent. I took up my job in the midst of a tremendous expansion program. Approval had been given to build the Restigouche-class destroyers and Sonderan-class destroyers. In fact, they were well underway. But there were very few people in headquarters capable of doing the engineering and the specifications and everything that was necessary. And our office space was even more limited. We were extremely crowded. Everybody was sharing an office with one or two or three other people. I found myself responsible for all of the mechanical equipment that was going into these ships and into any other ships that were being built, and there were quite a few being built, including minesweepers and gate vessels and other miscellaneous ships. All this activity resulted from the fact that the Korean War was on. And our biggest problem by far was trying to get staff to help write the specifications, approve drawings, and otherwise avoid the government being the delaying agent in their own programs. The Civil Service Commission at that stage didn't seem to know how to recruit highly skilled technical people at all. And in fact, the sort of people we wanted were only available in one or two places, mainly in the United Kingdom, but some from Germany. And the Civil Service Commission had no machinery, as far as I could see, for recruiting people from these sources. The production of the ships was at that time the responsibility, joint responsibility, of the Department of National Defense and the Department of Defense Production. Fortunately for all, the Department of Defense Production was headed by Mr. C.D. Howe as minister, and he was the greatest corner cutter that has ever been around Ottawa, I think. And when he discovered that the Department of National Defense was going to be the agency which was delaying its own programs due to lack of personnel, he immediately gave the order for the shipyards and the machinery manufacturers, who are our contractors, to hire additional people and to lend them to us.
Right. Here we are. Yep.
By us, I mean that to the Royal Canadian Navy, Naval Headquarters. So the result was that we found ourselves going to England, finding draftsmen and instrumentation engineers and turbine engineers and boiler engineers, that sort of thing, persuading them to come to Canada, which fortunately wasn't too difficult at that stage because there was a lot of disenchantment with life in the UK around that period. And then we would arrange for a shipyard such as Canadian Vickers or a turbine manufacturer such as John Inglis, or machinery manufacturers such as Peacock Brothers Limited to enter into a contractual arrangement with the gentleman in question, pay his passage to Canada for his wife and family, and find him a house and get him all established, and then charge the cost of his services to the government through the contract that we had with the Department of Defense Production. It was a very roundabout way of recruiting people, but it turned out to be quite effective. And so we were able to build up our staff rather quickly after that. And we were able to generate specifications, approve drawings, and so on, which had been submitted by shipyards fairly quickly, starting from about, I think, the end of 1952. The most sophisticated equipment we had to deal with during that period was the main machinery for the Sonneron and Restigouche classes of ship, the destroyer. And the machinery was known as the Y-100. It was the code name it had been given in England, where it had been designed for some Royal Navy destroyers as well. However, the Y-100 machinery that was to go into the Canadian ships had to be built in Canada, be capable of being built in Canada, rather. And before that could happen, we had to build the machinery plants that could build the machinery. And all this was a race against time because the ships themselves were under construction. So we arranged to have some of the first sets of machinery built in England and in Switzerland. The turbines were built in England. The gearboxes, which were probably the most sophisticated of all, were hardened and ground gears. And they could only be cut on some gear-cutting machines that were manufactured by the Moog Machinery Company of Zurich, Switzerland. Now, Moog Machinery Company were really machine tool manufacturers, not gear manufacturers. However, they did consent to manufacture the gears for the first ship for us, but they didn't have any facilities in Zurich for testing them. So it was arranged that the testing of the first complete set of machinery, that is the first set of turbines and gearbox combined, would be carried out at Newcastle-on-Tyne at an establishment called Pametrada, P-A-M-E-T-D-R-A, I suppose it was, which was a pseudonym for the Parsons Admiralty Marine Engineering Testing Establishment, or something such as that. It's a long time ago. But anyway, I remember this establishment was headed by a Dr. Brown, the civilian. And he was paid jointly by a consortium of machinery manufacturers and the Admiralty, and so were all his staff. So we finally got the gearboxes from Zurich and the turbines from Vickers, I believe it was, in England, and assembled the whole thing at Pametrada and carried out a series of tests. And we immediately ran into problems. The gears started to scuff, as it were, because they were overloaded, even though they were especially hardened and ground to extremely fine tolerances. So we then had to develop special, what they called extreme pressure lube oil. And one of the oil companies in England developed this special lubricating oil, which was just known as EP oil, as far as I can recall. And it seemed to stop the scuffing, but the additives in the oil attacked the copper in the system, and we had bearing failures elsewhere. So after a while, they modified the lube oil so it had different additives, and it stopped the scuffing, and it didn't eat up the copper in the bearings either. And so in due course, we finally had a satisfactory test on the first set of machinery, and it was shipped to Canada to be installed in HMCS Sonora on the first ship of the class. Going hand in hand with all of this was the need to build the facilities to build the machinery for the rest of the ships. And this was done in a variety of places. The gearboxes were built at Dominion Engineering in a naval engineering, naval gear plant, I guess it was called, which was built on Dominion Engineering property and was managed by them, but it was used exclusively to manufacture the gearboxes for the Canadian destroyers. The various pieces of auxiliary machinery were manufactured by Peacock Brothers, who were a subsidiary of the parent company in England called J&J Weir. So the Weir's machinery was manufactured by Peacock, and again Peacocks were given certain facilities by the government, or had certain facilities built for them by the government, including a test a building which was known as the Naval Engineering Test Establishment, NEET. And it still exists today, because after it finished its initial job, it was used for testing anything and everything that came along afterwards. The naval gear plant was closed down after the program completed, and because there were no follow-on programs, the machinery was dismantled and sold. And it was a great tragedy, because the facilities that existed in Canada 25 or 30 years ago no longer exist. The other forms of machinery, a lot of them were built by W.H. Allen of Bedford, England, and they entered into an arrangement with Canadian Westinghouse of Hamilton, Ontario, and all of the Allen machinery, turbo generators, turbo blowers, and the like, were manufactured in Hamilton, tested in Hamilton, by Canadian Westinghouse. The boilers were manufactured by Foster Wheeler at Galt, Ontario, and there again, same sort of thing. They manufactured them in their own facilities, but testing was a joint effort. And propellers were manufactured at Kennedy Brothers at Owen Sound, Ontario.
Mm-hmm. Were these, these were very large propellers, weren't they, for our, comparatively speaking?
No, they weren't terribly large, they were fixed pitch propellers, this particular bench. And they weren't terribly large, but they were fairly high speed. Because the ships were specified very low tolerances on noise and vibration, they had to be very accurately machined, and special alloys that were corrosion resistant and so on, and specially tight fit of the propeller to the shaft and so on. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of trouble with propellers, A, getting the accuracy, and B, getting the degree of fit that was specified. We discovered along the way, as I recall, that the degree of accuracy which had been specified by the Admiralty designers was much more severe than it needed to be, and we finally found out that no one was meeting the specification in England either, so we finally relaxed these to a more sensible level. The turbine rotors were an interesting thing. These are the big chunks of steel forgings out of which you machine the turbine rotor and eventually attach the blades, and it's a very highly stressed piece of equipment and has to be of the highest quality steel. The contract was arranged with Dominion Foundries and Steel, who actually poured the steel to make the ingots in their steel mill in Montreal, and then they loaded them in, loaded these red-hot ingots into flat cars surrounded with insulation, and shipped them all the way to Trenton, Nova Scotia, where they had a press that pressed the ingot into the desired shape of forging.
They kept hot all that way?
Kept hot all the way, yes, yes.
Yeah. That's a Canadian car, I guess.
Yes. No, it was the Dominion Foundries and Steel. It was the DeFasco plant, yeah. Kept hot all the way. And then finally the completed rotor, after it had been through the press. And the press, incidentally, was another piece of equipment that was bought by the Canadian government, but farmed out to Dominion Foundries and Steel. And then the completed piece of machinery was shipped to John Ingalls in Toronto, who machined it to size and fitted the blades and turned out the finished turbine. I could go on and on, but pieces of equipment such as that manufactured just about every plant you could visit in Canada during that period.
A matter of policy, I suppose, in a way, in the design of these ships, but the question has arisen in my mind why you used the Y-100 engines, which propelled the ship at a slower speed, perhaps, than the existing destroyers in the fleet. I'm thinking of the Crescent Crusader, the Tribals, the Saint Laurent class were slower, and I'm just wondering what the...
Well, that was a combination of a variety of things. Speed was sacrificed in the interests of endurance. Slower speed, but they could carry more fuel and could stay at sea longer than the Tribals could. So it was a compromise all around.
Were they smaller engines than the other ships?
Yes, they were. They were. Yes,
well, that
yes,
would have made
were.
A difference,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, they were smaller, yeah. Smaller engines. I think 30,000 horsepower versus 44,000 or something in the older ships. Mm-hmm. But very efficient when it came to fuel consumption. And they had... they had another very interesting feature in that the main engines were in fact two separate engines for each shaft, a cruising turbine and a main turbine. Mm-hmm. Now, this was not the first time this had been done, of course. As far back as World War I, ships were built with separate cruising turbines that could be clutched in and clutched out to... and the idea was that the cruising turbine was very economical on fuel, but had very limited horsepower. So as long as the ship was just going from A to B and was content to cruise at 14 knots or thereabouts, and was prepared to stop the shaft while they clutched in the cruising turbines, they were a fine thing. But on these ships, we wanted automatic transmission, as it were. We wanted the cruising turbines that would clutch in and out automatically. While the ship was moving, yes. And you could stop the ship dead in the water and the cruising turbine would declutch itself, and you could speed up and the cruising turbine would clutch in until you got up to the speed that was too high for it, and then it would clutch itself out and the main one would take over,
yeah,
and so on.
Exactly
like the automatic transmission in the car, except instead of having two engines in the car, you only have one.
Yeah.
In these ships, you had two engines, and the load was shifted from one to the other automatically. Well, these clutches gave no end of trouble, getting them designed so that they would do everything that they were supposed to do. But we finally got them working properly and installed them in the ships, and they stayed there for about half the life of the ship. And eventually, the cruising turbines were taken out, partly because they were having some problems with the clutch, but also as a weight-saving device, and they decided to sacrifice a bit of efficiency, after all, in the interests of having a less complicated system. But the cruising turbines did work, make no mistake about that.
How much input into the design of these various systems did you have in Ottawa? Or were you simply in the specification?
The basic design was worked out by a team of Admiralty experts at a place at Yarrows on the Clyde Bank in Scotland. And Yarrows is a shipyard, but they recruited and set up a team of design engineers, and they called themselves YARD, Y-A-R-D. And that was a short term for Yarrow Admiralty Research Department. And again, these engineers were all hired and paid by Yarrows, but they were selected by the Admiralty. And they developed the Y-100 machinery. Sorry, I've forgotten your question, though.
How much input did your organization have in the design of these, or were you simply calling, made the specifications and asked other people to design them to those specs?
Well, we didn't have much input in the initial design because, as I say, it was done by the specifications were conceived by the Yarrow Admiralty Research Department. But they fell short of going into a lot of detail. And also, the specifications vary widely from ship to ship. You can have the same machinery in two different ships, and the specifications are quite different because other characteristics of the ship are different. And so, we certainly had complete responsibility. That is, a group of Canadians had complete responsibility for the specification for the Canadian ships. But a lot of pieces of those specifications were lifted from the Admiralty specification. But when it came to the ship layout and the ship design, our ships were quite different than anything that the Admiralty was building. So naturally, the ship specification was quite a lot different.
You designed the hull entirely?
Yes. I have to distinguish here. In those days, Navy was still divided up along departmental lines. And the Naval Constructor Department was responsible for the hull design, and there was a Naval Constructor in Chief, or Chief of Naval Construction, I guess he was called, who had the overall responsibility for designing the hull and coordinating design of everything else that went into it.
Was that Rowley Baker?
That was Rowley Baker, Commodore Rowley Baker.
Yeah.
That's right. And he was on loan to us, to the Canadian Navy, from the Admiralty. Similarly, there was an engineer in chief who was responsible for all the machinery, and he was my superior. I was assistant engineer in chief. There was an electrical engineer in chief who was responsible for all of the electrics and electronics in the ship. And there was a Director General of Naval Ordnance who was responsible for all of the guns and ammunition and that sort of thing in the ship. Those four large technical departments were responsible for the ship design. And there was, in turn, a supply officer in chief who was responsible for all the stores and outfitting and that sort of thing.
I suppose you must have had many conferences at a fairly high level to marry all these different ideas together.
Well, we had lots of conferences. they weren't always at the high level. Quite often they were in a parlor car in a train or a hotel room or a smoke-filled room in Naval Headquarters. I can remember being in a room about 10 by 14 or something with about 14 people in it and everybody smoking and the air just blew. And nowadays you wouldn't be allowed to do that.
No, I guess not.
By the non-smokers. We had conferences after conferences after conferences and trips and visits and trips and visits. The contractors visiting Ottawa and Ottawa personnel visiting visiting the contractor's yards. And we,
how was how were your relations with the contractor? Were you at loggerheads often or ever?
The relationship with the contractors in those days was very good. I say in those days it was very good, and it was good by comparison with what happened later on. It was a cooperative effort and a joint effort, and the main feature of these ships was that the costs were built. Ships were built under the cost plus system of contracting. In other words, the contractor was paid for all of his legitimate costs plus a percentage markup for profit. There are those who say that that's an inefficient system, and perhaps in some ways it is, but when you're doing something for the first time, it's probably the only system that really works. Because later on, when we tried fixed price tenders for complicated new ships, we found that it had all sorts of problems, that you could get a fixed price all right, but extras were to be billed separately, and the bills for extras were just phenomenal. And instead of a cooperative system, the fixed price thing turned out to be a confrontation system. In other words, The contractor and the builders were, and the government were always in confrontation. Whereas on the cost plus system, they all had their shoulder to the same wheel and were trying to get the job done.
Right.
The government had to have inspectors around to make sure that there wasn't too much loafing or feather bedding, but apart from that, and that wasn't too difficult. And so it worked out quite well, I think.
Did you find the system of allocating vessels to different shipyards was fairly efficient or not very efficient?
Yes.
Because some were so far apart?
No, allocating, as I recall, we had seven different yards involved in the program. Halifax, Quebec City, Sorel, Montreal, Vancouver, and Victoria. That's not seven, is it? Halifax, Quebec, Sorel, Montreal, four, Burrards, and Yarrows was six. Oh, yes, and Victoria Machinery Depot. There were two in Victoria. Victoria Machinery Depot. The way it worked on the West Coast, the ships were launched at Burrards, but then were fitted out at Yarrows or Victoria Machinery Depot, in addition to being fitted out at Burrards. On the East Coast, the ships were launched and fitted out in the same yards. I think part of of our duty, I feel, was to develop what's known as industrial preparedness, and that is have industry in Canada prepared to meet the requirements of the Department of National Defense in wartime. And you can't really do that unless you give them something to do in peacetime. And under the system we had every shipyard that was worth anything and almost every machine manufacturer was worth anything working on the job. There were very few major companies that were excluded. So to that extent, I think it was effective, whether it was efficient or not.
Unfortunately, for only a short time.
Right.
Yeah.
If the contracts had been let on a strictly competitive bidding system, the West Coast would have been ruled out entirely because of the higher wage rates on the West Coast. So there would have been no West Coast ships built. Equally, I think the Maritimes would have been ruled out because their productivity has never been quite as good as it has been in the St. Lawrence. It perhaps is better now, but at one stage it wasn't terribly good. So I feel it was probably the most effective system that we ever had for building ships, and it was much the same as the way the corvettes and the frigates were built in Canada during the war.
What sort of follow-up did you have on these vessels after they were operational? great deal of design changes required, or not much, or some modification?
Well, it wasn't too bad. It wasn't too bad at all. The ships worked remarkably well, and I think the first to go to the scrap heap was HMCS Sonoran,
yeah.
Which
went just recently. Yeah.
And that's, almost 30 years after they were laid down.
Didn't even get there, actually.
That one didn't get there. It was lost in the storm or something at sea.
Yeah.
There were no real major faults. There was one... there was a bit of a crisis that I alluded to with cruising turbines, but that was got around.
Yeah.
And after the ships had been in commission about 3 or 4 years, all of a sudden, one particular boiler tube in almost every ship in the fleet suddenly burned out and caused a problem. And I've forgotten, I think there were hundreds of tubes in a boiler, and I think this one was numbered B-52 or something like that. And it happened to be the tube that I guess had the least circulation of air past it and the greatest opportunity for clinkers to form around it. And so it was the first one to burn out. Strangely enough, the tube didn't burn out in any of them until I think about 1958 or 59, and the ships were in commission from about 55. So it took that long for this problem to develop. And there was a bit of a crisis, and I remember being the author of a little program called Superfix. The idea was to hang in there and try to solve this problem, find out what was causing it, and get it fixed in all the ships. And so I was a project officer for Superfix. And it didn't take long. We discovered what the problem was. It related to the fuel that we were importing from Venezuela, which had a high vanadium content, and too high, in fact. And this resulted in this... these clinkers being formed, which were just like iron, and nothing would remove them. So we got around it by switching ships over to diesel fuel instead of having bunker
fuel.
Oh,
really? You could burn diesel fuel, didn't you?
Yes, you could. It was more expensive.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was more efficient in the long run because of the lack of boiler cleaning and so on. It could have been got around also by importing oil from the Middle East or somewhere, but since our contracts were all with Imperial Oil through Venezuela, that wasn't very practical.
Yeah.
And so we did eventually switch the ships over to diesel fuel.
That required just anything more elaborate than perhaps new nozzles on your burners, or?
No, that was about the sort of thing.
Yeah.
You didn't have to heat the oil anymore, or you heated it very little.
Yeah.
You had to sort of modify your equipment to make sure you weren't overheating it, otherwise you've had explosions and fire.
Yeah.
Diesel oil is more flammable in the raw state than bunker fuel is, so you have to be more careful with it all the time. But as I say, the heating problem was considerably reduced, and it was more clean and efficient all around. There may have been some minor problems, but nothing that required any Einstein to solve.
Yeah. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. Perhaps that's enough on the Sonoran class. Suffice it to say that all these facilities that were built up, most of them disappeared, except for the Naval Engineering Test Establishment.
They would have been gone by when, about 56 or 57?
No, later than that.
Later.
Yeah, in the 60s, I think, because although they were still manufacturing spare parts and they were kept in being in the hopes of becoming involved in future programs and so on, so they didn't disappear quite as soon as they might have.
Were they used for the next class of ships at all?
The Naval Engineering Test Establishment was. The gearing plant perhaps was used to a minor extent, but very little. One other facility, though, that I should have mentioned, and this didn't belong entirely to the engineer-in-chief, but it belonged to all of the chiefs, And that was the Naval Central Drawing Office, NCDO as it was called, and it was established at Canadian Vickers. Now, the theory behind this Naval Central Drawing Office was that each of the shipyards would send some of their draftsmen to work in Montreal, and they would work as a joint team and would prepare one set of drawings, and all the shipyards would work to them. Well, that was a good theory. The trouble was that the shipyards really didn't have any draftsmen.
No, really?
And, or if they did, they were already busy with their commercial work, and there was no surplus of draftsmen. And certainly, if you were a draftsman working for Burrards on the West Coast, you didn't want to go and live in Montreal for the next 5 years.
No.
And so the result was that the shipyards had virtually no one to send to Montreal to form the Naval Central Drawing Office. So again, Mr. C.D. Howe's solution was to tell Canadian Vickers to hire the draftsmen wherever they could get them, employ them in the Naval Central Drawing Office under contract, and then bill the costs of operating the Naval Central Drawing Office to the ship contract. And this was done. And I think the Naval Central Drawing Office had as many as 150 draftsmen in it, in its heyday. And it remained in being, it may still be in being, I'm not quite sure, but it was certainly in being when I retired in 1972. And it was in being after that, but I believe it's been drastically reduced since that time. Again, part of the theory being that contractors should be responsible on a fixed price basis for designing, building, testing, and doing everything else, and having this Naval Central Drawing Office seemed to be splitting responsibility away from the contractor. So, I think perhaps that's enough on the DDH, on the Sonneron class, 205 and 257 class of ship.
Yeah.
I left that job as assistant engineer-in-chief in the summer of 1955, about the time that the first of the ships was commissioned. And I was sent to be the chief engineer of the Bonaventure, which was building in Belfast, Northern Ireland. And I spent the next 2 years in Belfast, standing by the Bonaventure, getting ready to man the ship when it was commissioned, and helping with inspection and testing while it was under construction.
Now, the hull and a good bit of the ship had been built during the war, immediately after, hadn't it? So it had been sitting around for about 10 years, is that correct?
Yeah, the basic hull was built by the Admiralty during the war. And the main engines as such, but not the auxiliaries, so were installed.
What sort of condition was she in when you came upon her?
She was in good condition.
Yeah?
Because she'd been well preserved. The ship had been launched and then put in a state of preservation. There wasn't too much in it, so it wasn't difficult to preserve. But the ship that finally emerged was quite different because, in the meantime, things like the angled deck and the steam catapult and all sorts of mirror landing devices had been invented, although not developed, really. And these were all to be incorporated in the Bonaventure. Also, there were all Canadian communications systems were installed, the Canadian system of habitability, in other words, living accommodation and spaces, were to be Canadian. So it was basically an Admiralty hull that had been completely Canadianized, or even if it had remained as an Admiralty hull, it would have been quite different in 1957 than if it had been finished in 1945. The Australians bought one from the Admiralty about the same time. In fact, theirs commissioned a few months before Bonaventure did. And so we were able to go to sea for a few days their ship, the Sydney, I believe it was, and find out where the problems were in that ship and then try to have them solved in ours. Their ship was built at, Vickers and Barrow.
I understand there was a problem with the wiring, because much of the main wiring was originally installed in 45, and it just didn't stand up as well as it ought to have. And you, when you connect it into it, if you will, is that a?
No, I'm not sure that that's true. I think the main. The ring main as such may have been installed, but there was very little branch wiring installed. That was all done afterwards. And while it may have developed problems towards the end of the ship's life, I don't recall any serious problems with the wiring in the first 2 years while I was in the ship.
Yeah.
But I can well believe that there may have been problems later on. The ship's turbo generators were the ones that would have been installed for the Admiralty, and so there was no problem there. But the diesel generators were selected in Canada and supplied from Canada, Canada and the U.S. They were Fairbanks Morse, as I recall, and I think they were better than anything that they would have had in them had they been built in England. They were extremely good, the diesel generators. Noisy as they always are, but ran very well, very efficient. And so I don't think that there was, it's fair to say that there were too many problems until perhaps later in the life of the ship.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had heard that there was a problem from this source later on, and it was laid at the door of the fact that there was some pretty old wiring in places.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Again, under the departmental system, we had an electrical officer as well as an engineer officer, and the electrical officer had the responsibility for that sort of thing. But I was aware of what was going on. The building of that ship was a fairly frustrating experience, but very interesting too. We enjoyed living in Belfast. Frustrating, I think, is the Canadians developed a system for supervising it which wasn't too efficient. They established two groups of Canadians in Belfast, one at each end of the shipyard. And one was the group of ship's officers, those who were going to go to sea in the ship, and the men who were going to form part of the crew. And that was an ever-increasing number until the day the ship commissioned it was, several hundred. And the other group was called the Principal RCN Technical Representative. And that group were a small group of technical officers whose job was to act as a liaison between the Admiralty, the shipyard, and naval headquarters. And unfortunately, they felt that their job was to keep the ship's personnel out of the act as far as possible. And on the other hand, they weren't a big enough group to handle the job by themselves. They just had to use the ship's personnel to supplement them. I solved the problem for my department by volunteering to wear two hats. One hat is responsible to the captain of the ship, and the other hat responsible to PRC and TR. And I put my entire staff at the disposal of both authorities, and from there on it worked fairly well. The electrical officer was always on the staff of PRC and TR, so there wasn't a problem there. But it was a very awkward organizational arrangement. And